G'day folks, talked to Benny Clark, the drummer for Baker Boy, an endorsed Pearl artist also, and we jump in to his love of music and the general scene around Victoria where he grew up, thriving scene, and some of the bands that he's been in the past, Super Heist and others, and where that journey ended up leading into running into Denzel Baker, that fella from up north in Arnhem Land, and becoming the drummer for Baker Boy. And them two getting the juices flowing musically, leading the tours around the country. And when we yarn about general Aboriginality and some of the touchy subjects there too. So when we're talking about what we've got in common, because we're both fair-skinned Koori's, Aboriginals, and just that we all come in different shades. You don't have to be black. And touching also into mental health. Can't wait to see on the music circuit, you two fellas and the rest of the crew, nationally, and what you can do abroad. You know, it's almost like an education, what you guys are doing musically. You know, it's powerful stuff. So keep it up. Solid work. And if you like the podcast, hit that subscribe button. It'd be much appreciated. And we've also got a Patreon page. There's a link below or within the descriptions. Click into that, check it out. And if you contribute, that's going to help the channel, the podcast, even further. So that'd be awesome. And we want to thank our sponsors, Permobil Australia, the greatest electric wheelchairs in the land. Wouldn't be sitting in anything else but these four wheels right here. And they've got great assistive tech also. So righto, let's get into it.
Keep rolling with Jake Briggs.
Oh, yeah.
Benny Clark, brother, thanks for jumping on the podcast and having a yarn, mate. Much appreciated.
My absolute pleasure.
Mate, so just tell us a bit about, you know, where you're from and, you know, importantly, where's your mob from?
Yeah, so I'm a Gunai Kurnow man. So I'm from, my family's based from a little mission called Bungyanda down in East Gippsland, or Lake Tyres Mission, as most people know it as. And I'm also Jupurung, which is up kind of Ararat way.
Yeah, right. Yeah, good stuff. So, yeah, Koori lad from down south then, eh?
That's it.
Yeah, solid. So, mate, how's it all going, like, especially down that way when you're talking about COVID and lockdowns and, you know, how's it, you know, affecting yourself? And, you know, it's pretty, like, it's hard where I am up in New South Wales. I'm up on the Central Coast, but you guys have copped it a bit down in Victoria there.
Yeah, we've kind of been up and down for the last 2 years now or something. It's kind of felt like it's gone on forever. But no, we're still in lockdown again. We had a little glimpse of hope when we come out of lockdown and we started to get life back to normal. But, you know, COVID quickly come and bit us back in the ass again. So we're back to square one. But no, look, I think this one's definitely been harder because we did have that little glimpse of, you know, the possibility of coming out. And we got to, you know, I got to do a couple of shows in between there. So it was kind of like, here's what you're missing. And now I'm going to take it back away again. but no, Cruz and I'm just trying to stay busy. And, you know, I've got my kit and I've got my home gym and, you know, I work from home as well. So just trying to stay active and stay sane, really.
Yeah, that's the best thing, eh? Just keeping active, keeping stimulated. So,
yeah, that's it. Anything you can do to keep your brain moving.
Yeah, so, and that's the main thing, you know, just staying active and, you know, whether that's got to do with your music and, you know, or it's throwing the tunes on and getting in the gym and getting a sweat out and, you know, throwing, you know, a bit of death metal and push-ups or whatever it is, bro, you know what I mean?
That's it. So you know what I'm talking about.
Yeah. So, mate, that red touring kit that you unveiled the other day, that was, you know, on Instagram. That was, it's pretty flash. And just letting you know, I ended up voting for the red one. So, I know.
Oh, you did? Oh, beautiful.
Yeah, a lot of mob, you know, pushing towards a tangerine. Like, that looks nice too. But, yeah. I like the red. So,
I was actually spewing because I was set on the tangerine. I'm like, that's what I want, but I wanted to make sure. Yep. And, you know, due to COVID and you know, all the stuff that I get, particularly from Europe, Pearl, so, and it gets sent through Australian Pearl, there's just no stock of anything. And, like, I was actually going for the clear kit originally.
But, that'd be nice.
You know, I got talking to my A&R guy, and he sent me some photos of the red one, and I'm like, and I hit up Baker Boy, and I'm like, which one do you reckon? He goes, tangerine. I'm like, do you like the red one? No. So I think I have to get this one. And he's like, nah, the red's sick. The red's sick. That's actually what's set up behind me now.
Oh.
So that's it there.
Give us a rundown of the kit. Like what's going on when you're talking about each sort of piece there and how it's set up there, bro?
Yeah, so I'm endorsed by Pearl Drums. So this isn't the whole kit yet. I've still got an 8-inch rack tom and a 14-inch floor tom coming, which are on back order. So I'll be running an 8, 10, to 20 by 16 kick, a 14 and a 16 floor tom. And all the cymbals are Zildjian, but it's going to be a whole new setup for Baker Boy. So I don't have a particular setup. This is the setup I've just been running for a while. But we're adding new stuff into the Baker Boy setup. So it's going to have extra toms and extra bits and pieces and electronics and cymbals. So,
yeah, that's what I was going to hit you up about. Like, so you've got, like, you know, a traditional setup there, but what's, when you got the electronics, what gets fed in there apart from, you know, obviously mics and whatnot, but if it's, what other sort of control systems get thrown on or whatever it may be?
Yeah, so we run everything through MIDI. So our MD, Toby Chu Lee, who works for 100,000 other artists as well, and I guess most people know him as the Veronica's guitarist, and our guitarist as well. But everything gets basically run through his two laptops. So everything's triggered off by click. So I have an SPD pad on the side.
Yep.
Which we're actually going to move away from the SPD, and I'm going to have separated pads around the kit. But, you know, let's say In Control comes in. So once the backing tracks for In Control come in, that it automatically clicks my SPD over to In Control, and I have whatever song we're playing. And I'll have, you know, my second snares, my claps, my, you know, all that kind of gear. It all just runs automatically through there.
That's pretty tech. Like, it's come a long way with what you can do and harness music, whether that's got to do with traditional acoustic style instruments and then bridging in the whole electronics. Like, it's full on.
It's crazy.
Yeah. But let's reel it back, brother. Mm. Drums, the love of drums. Yeah. Where did all that kick off and where'd that start?
I actually had this conversation the other day, and it was, so I have, ADHD and Asperger's. So I kind of have these two people tearing. One, I like to start things and I tend to not finish a lot of things, or I get excited and, or I can get completely fixated on something and it never goes away. So when I was a kid, all my mates rode motorbikes. So dad went and got me a motorbike, you know, this little Pee Wee 80 thing. I was like 7 or 8 years old. Nice. And I was out riding one day and I got attacked by a dog while I was out on the motorbike thing, whatever you call it.
Did it latch on or what?
Yeah, grabbed hold of me boot and then whatever else. And then I just remember, you know, I was behind dad. Dad had the motorbike and, like, it was a public place and it was the owner's dog. So it was a bit of a weird one. But I made it clear to dad, I never want to ride a motorbike again. I hate the thing. I never want to touch it. You know, my dad rides bikes still, like a road bike and everything else. And after we sold, he's like, well, what do you want? I'm like, oh, I want a drum kit. And at the time, I was just starting to get into, you know, having my own musical taste.
Yeah.
You know, my dad brought me up on things like, you know, the Clash and Sex Pistols and, you know, that.
Yeah, nice.
That old school English punk. English punk. So my dad's English. And, he loves that English punk. So I was brought up in that sort of stuff. And then, you know, my mum's side, I had, you know, my Fleetwood Macs and that kind of stuff as well. But then I started to delve into, like, I found Korn and I found Slipknot and I found all these bands in the mid late 90s, and there was just something about the drums that set me off. Mum's like, well, with ADHD and your whatever else, this might actually be good for you. But at the same time, they were thinking, oh, it'll be a phase. We'll deal with the drum kit for 6 months and he'll sell it and get rid of it and it won't be a drama. And 22 years later, I'm now playing professionally, or have been playing professionally for about 15 years.
That's
so that wasn't so much a phase. Yeah.
So were you driving them nuts? Like, you know, where'd you have the, because drum kits allowed as, like, did you have it set up in your bedroom or like what was the go there with blasting them away?
No, we didn't have a very big house when I was growing up. So it was set up in the front room. We had like this really small lounge room and then like a front room and then like the kitchen. So it was all adjoined. And mine was just in the front room. So it was, and when they bought it, the first thing that the Billy Hyde's music at the time gave me those rubber pad things.
Yep.
The stoppers to put on the kit. So during the week, I was only allowed to play it with the stoppers on.
Yeah,
but yeah, I was at the point where I drove everyone nuts. But then when I was older, like, you know, 18, 19, I'd practice drums in this very garage and my mum would sleep on the couch in the next room and would have no idea that I was playing.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
So it went from a pain to it's just the usual noise in the house.
Yeah, so you're listening. So you're named like, you know, you threw out the Korns and Slipknot and, you know, the Joey Jordison of the world and just that fast-paced, full-on, in-your-face drumming style, blast beats and all that sort of stuff. So with Mr. Jordison and some of the other drummers, so who was inspiring you at the time if you're going to throw off a few, and what type of genres, whether that's got to do with straight metal or if it was an infusion of other mobs coming into the mix?
Didn't really have a specific Jordison. That's what made me want to go, okay, to play this properly. And I want a job pretty set in stone that this is what my job's going to be. I'm going to do this. To formulate and find different guys that I liked. And I guess the good thing about my upbringing in some of the guys that I became friends with, a lot of it was local bands. You know, I loved Korn and you know, Segregation, Blood Duster, Damaged, Sunk Lotto. They were kind of like the bands that really inspired us, because we could sit here.
Yeah.
Oh, sorry, you broke up a little bit there.
Nah, yeah, sorry, brother. No, I was just saying Sunk Lotto. I haven't heard of that band for a long time, man. Yeah.
But yeah, they were the bands, because we could go and watch them at a local venue on a Saturday at an all-ages show. And like, we can stand here and they can stand there and we can do that same thing if we wanted to. It wasn't that far away. It wasn't as far reached as Slipknot and Machine Head and Cradle of Filth. It was like, no, they're right there. We can do that.
That's awesome. And what was the local scene like when you're a youngster and sort of you're seeing Sunk Lotto and some of the other local bands and what's going on, and you're thinking, yeah, I want to get in the mix of this, whether it's doing my own thing, jumping in with a band or what was going on?
The local scene was huge. It was massive. I mean, I grew up in this little town and so many big bands came out of this little town. You know, across Victoria, the scene was really, really, really healthy. There was countless amount of venues. We still had the old school, you know, all ages shows. You know, the band would play on the Saturday afternoon and then play the Saturday night. We had a venue in the city called the Art House, and that pretty much made and bred most of the artists that you saw at that time, but that you see today. Like at the Art House, I've seen from Friends of Rom to 28 Days, the Cog, Butterfly Effect, you know, Blood Duster, Damage, Sunk Lotto, Frankenbach, all those bands as well. You know, the scene was really healthy.
Yeah, that's awesome. So, and what was your inspiration? Well, I shouldn't say inspiration, so, because you've talked about with some of the local bands and overseas ones that you've jumped into and listened to. So I always get intrigued. So like before I was in a wheelchair, so, you know, I used to play guitar and just, like, my method of learning, I, you know, never got into reading music, but, you know, straight off tabs or listening to music and picking up that way. And I always get intrigued by the way how people learn their instrument, whether it's, you know, traditionally reading off, you know, music itself or tabs, or if you just throw on the headphones and just listening to that song and just tapping away. Like, what was your method of learning drums, brother?
So I had 1 year of drum lessons with this bloke named Joe O'Keen, and he was one of the most amazing. He was the first guy that said to me, what music do you listen to? I said, punk music. And he goes, cool, I'm never going to teach you punk music. I'm going to teach you jazz.
Right.
Okay. Like, and me in, like, you know, I'm like, what do I want to learn jazz for? Jazz is old people music. Like, what do I care about jazz? Now I'm 33 and I listen to a lot of jazz. But he finished up at my school and I got another drum teacher and we just didn't get along at all. I was paying him to teach me and he was asking me to teach him how to use a double pedal. And I'm like, this doesn't make sense. This doesn't work out. So I learned everything by ear. Everything that I have is I guess, identifying what he's hitting and how he's hitting it. I mean, the beautiful thing these days, you can go on YouTube and watch them do it. But no, I used to sit with cassettes, not even CDs. I used to sit with my cassette player. And
I'm hearing you.
I used to sit with my cassette player and learn how to play songs. I just sit there with the sticks and go, it sounds like he's hitting the ride cymbal there. And this is how that roll sounds. And yeah, I just, everything by ear.
Yeah, nice. So were you getting into a few bands when you were younger? So was there anything that, like, what sort of kicked off your career, whether it's got to do with session work or you're actually in a band sort of starting to make a mark for yourself? So where'd all that come about?
Yeah, so I don't know if you've heard of a band called Boris the Blade at all from Melbourne.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah. So Sharpie, they're going to hate me for this. Sharpie, the singer from Boris the Blade, was in year 7 and I was in year 8.
Right.
And we did drum lessons together. So
okay,
Sharpie's been my best mate for 22 years or something. So we did drum lessons together. And we had this mutual friend at school that he was only in the band for a little while, but there was a battle of the bands in the small town that I'm at, and I met this bass player and guitarist. And we're like, oh, we should jam sometime. And I'm talking like I'm in year 9, year 8.
Yeah, so he's still like, pretty young.
Cool. Still really young. So, of course, I come home and went, Mum, met these random kids and I want them to come over and we're going to play music together. So the bass player that I met at that Battle of the Bands was Kobe, the bass player from Boris the Blade. So we started jamming, we started writing some songs. We went up to his house, people come to my house, and whatever else. And then we needed a singer. We had no one to sing. And I'm like, look, my best mate's a drummer, but I want him to be in the band. Like, I reckon we should ask him to sing. So I kind of didn't even call him. I walked from my house, like it's a good 8K walk. Walked from my house to his house, knocked on his door, and I went, oi, Sharpie, I want you to sing for my band. He goes, I don't sing, I play drums. I'm like, well, you don't really have a choice because you're my best mate and I want you to be in the band and I'm a better drummer than you. It was all right then. His first time singing was at our first show. He never screamed, nothing. He was too shy to do it at rehearsal.
Wow. And
he wrote all the lyrics to the song. It was a talent show at the Gisborne Fair, if people know where Gisborne is. And we played one song. And the song, what was the song? Toll Away. Yeah, I remember what the song was called. The song was called Toll Away. And, Sharpie was too scared to sing it at practice. So he's like, I'll just do it at the show. We got to the show. All our mates came from school. And we're even talking to the sound guy, like, you know, we do screamy, so you need to turn Sharpie's mic down a little bit. Didn't listen. Sharpie went on there, had his first ever scream, and it was super duper loud, like ridiculous loud. And then we got disqualified because we had a mosh pit. So we didn't end up getting anywhere in the competition anyway because we had a mosh pit. We got disqualified, which we feel is the better win than whatever their crappy $200 prize was. So we're quite happy with the with that. But yeah, from there, you know, we had, that was a band called Defect. Mm-hmm. Then me and Sharpie, so Kobe left for another band, and me and Sharpie made a band called Remains, which I'm actually trying to get that EP on Spotify at the moment. So that'll hopefully be up at some point. And then I went and joined, after Remains, I went and joined a band called Electric Dynamite, which was like an 80s kind of Motley Crue type band. And Sharpie went and started Boris the Blade with Lording and Kobe.
Yeah, right.
So that's the beginnings.
That's the beginnings. So you ended up in a bit of a hair metal band then, hey?
Yes. Yeah, I was. I was with Dynamite for 6 years. It was actually our album's 10th anniversary a couple of weeks ago, which is pretty amazing to know that I've had an album out for 10 years. And, you know, looking back on that, it's like, well, the guy I'm playing for now was 13 when my first real album came out. And he was, I think Denzel was like 8 when my first EP came out. So I'm a little bit older than them lads.
Yeah.
But yeah, it was very much like a Motley Crue slash new metal. It was kind of a mixture of lots of things, but it was that, we called it party metal.
Nice.
A lot of fun.
Nice.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, well, that's a good kickoff, man, you know, so getting a bit of a mix of everything. And it's interesting that you're talking about jazz, you know, so, and, you know, that's going to, at the end of the day, like, if you got multiple facets of different styles, that's just going to add to your repertoire of where you can bust out, and it's going to make yourself a better musician at the end of the day, that's for sure.
Yeah, so exactly.
How, you know, because I always found this a little bit of a struggle, like, growing up, but, like, being, like, you know, because I'm Koori, I'm Wanneroo, Kamilaroi, and the sort of, like, because I was listening to all that music when it's got to do with hard and heavy, like, I listen to everything, like, a bit of, you know, when it's got to do with hip-hop and all that, also rap right into that, but mainly gravitated towards, like, your metal, your punk, and your hardcore. And just with finding aboriginality around that, and, like, because a lot of mob, you know, whether it's family or just friends or whatnot, weren't into that style of music. But how'd you find yourself and your identity with that, brother, when it had to do with that, you know, that style of music, and then finding your way and your aboriginality and where that all sort of balanced out?
Yeah, well, it was funny. I mean, you look at, I guess, politically, what we go through as a people, and the way, you know, the stories you hear and you know, stuff you get when you're a pup. There wasn't really any, like, hard-hitting First Nations acts when I was a kid. I mean, we had Yothu Yindi and we had that rock and roll stuff, but there was something where I was angry about stuff, and there was nothing that would allow me to be angry, and music was the only thing I really had. Like, music was, you know, I had my family and I had my friends, but music was mine.
Yeah, okay.
No one could take music away from me, which is why I love bands like Sex Pistols, because they were political and they were angry, and I could be angry listening to music. And then there was this little band that came out called Rage Against the Machine, and that completely changed my world. It was like, this guy's so smart and so angry and so political, and oh my God, this makes me want to punch a hole through a wall. So I've always been the sort of person where, yes, I'm blackfellow and yes, I have my aboriginality, but it doesn't mean I have to. Yothu Yindi doesn't have to be my favorite band. And I don't have, you know what I mean? Like, I've always done whatever I wanted, whatever I liked, and I'm my own human being. And it wasn't until I started getting a little bit older, like, I mean, in my mid-20s, where I started to meet other black fellas that actually listened to heavier music. It wasn't like hip-hop or art.
Sorry, brother. So you just broke up for a minute, but you just said, so when you're looking at, you know, hip-hop and along the lines of that.
Okay.
So you just broke up there. So Rage Against the Machine and just how that pretty much changed everything from your perspective.
Yeah. So, yeah, it was bands like Rage Against the Machine that gave me that way to be political and angry and be able to express myself through someone else's music. Because, you know, back in my age group, I don't know how old you are, but my age group, every black fellow listened to R&B and hip-hop. Like, there was no one was really outside that circle. Oh. It wasn't until I got older that, you know.
100%. I'm hearing you because I'm, you know, around the same. I'm 36 and like a lot of mob around the way, like listening to hip hop and just that influence that it had. You know, it's a different channel of, you know, where people, you know, depending if it was back then, like, you know, if it's a lot of Tupac, Biggie, you know, NWA, Wu-Tang. I still love and listen to that stuff today.
So do I.
Yeah, love all that old school rap. And
But it was black music. Stuff.
Yeah.
It was that era of black music.
Yeah.
But I grew up in a very white town as well. Mm. And my best mates are not Aboriginal. They're not Indigenous. Mm. And that influence, you know, my dad's influence as well, and going down the path of Pistols to Metallica to Slayer. Mm. So it was like, you know, again, it was like Rage Against the Machine. That was kind of like that band that went, you know, I can listen to Tupac. That's very, you know, he's very poetic. He's very knowledgeable. He's very understanding, but he can be very hard. But there's nothing like a kick drum and that bass player and those lyrics in that band, like Rage Against the Machine. That just done it for me. It was like Tupac can be political and poetic. This dude just makes me want to punch shit, and I want to go punch shit. So I'm going to go with this fella.
That's awesome, bro. Yeah. So, and just because you just said they're putting it back on the town that you grew up in being a very white town, and, you know, and I'm, you know, just to put, so the listeners can get perspective on this too. Just like, and with myself, like on my father's side, he's fair skinned. And like with my mother, she's dark, and where that's the side of, you know, Aboriginality and First Nations being Wanneroo, Kamilaroi, but me and my brothers all come out pretty fair. And just growing up, like just when you're sitting around, whether it's been around friends or other people, and when you're talking about Aboriginality, like I've always said, you don't have to be black to be black. And, you know, we come, you know, all us black fellas come in all shades, but, and I still have this struggle today where I've been in circles where, you know, you're sitting around and obviously like black fellas will pick up if they're looking at my nose or whatever, and they can, or just the way I speak and know that, you know, there's Korean Aboriginality there. But when you're sitting around people and where they question your Aboriginality because of what you look like on face value, and then they start throwing the half cast, quarter cast, and all that crap. So, how'd you go and deal with that, brother? Like growing up, and
I got it tatted on my throat.
Was,
I got Corey tatted on my throat. Don't ask a stupid question. look, growing up, it was very hard. I always knew I was Aboriginal, and I was very staunch on that. But I mean, you know, like many families, my granddad had a pretty rough growing up, and he didn't really side with his Aboriginality too much because he still had those fears of the past. Mm. But always told us that we are, and you know, it wasn't until a certain age where he said, you know, it was we could start to be proud of it, where he wasn't allowed to be proud of it. So it was a bit rough for him. But you know, I went to an all-white school. I told everyone I was black. Obviously, didn't go down too well, especially in high school. Mm. But I was always real staunch on it. I was, this is who I am. I never really cared what other people thought of me. Like, I kind of had this thing in my head where, you know, most people don't like me anyway. So what does it matter if one more doesn't like me for me to be who I am? You know, look, I was an angry child, and I probably did a lot of it in the completely wrong way. But no, I was always real staunch on it, that this is who I am. And it wasn't until, you know, mid high school that those effects started showing. You know, I got kicked out of history class because I didn't believe that what they were teaching was correct. You know, it was 16 was the big breaker for me with my Aboriginality. That was when I started going, okay, I actually want to start knowing more. I want to know everything about it, not just the fact that I'm Aboriginal, because that didn't suffice me anymore. And, you know, granddad either didn't remember or didn't want to talk about a lot of things. So I had to go out and find it on my own. I had to go out and talk to elders and get into community a little bit more than just my family that I knew. And, you know, I got my license and I was out. I went driving around. I went go talking to people and find out, you know, where we're from and who we are. Like, it's always been that thing that no matter what in my life, you know, things can change, things can move. Baker Boy could kick me out tomorrow. I could lose all my friends. I could become homeless. I'm still going to be Blackfella at the end of the day. That's one thing that people can't take from me. That's who I am. And I'm very, very staunch on that. Again, 100%. I got it tatted on my throat because I've had to fight for it for so long that ask a stupid question and get a stupid answer.
That's it. You don't have to be black here.
That's
why
it's BLAK. BLAK was coined in the 80s. It was the 70s or the 80s. And BLAK, black, was a sense of identity, and BLACK was a color. So us as black fellows, I've always known it to be identified as BLAK, because that black is your identity and not a color.
Yeah, love it, brother. And that tattoo, because that's like, you know, you don't even have to open your mouth. It's right there. That's the shade of color that you are, you know. You're Koori, you're Aboriginal, and that's that, you know.
Yeah.
Love it, brother. Love it. So, mate, when you're getting in the mix of, like, where'd all this Baker Boy stuff come from, man? Like, how'd you come across this fellow that's from all the way up north, Arnhem Land? Like, how'd all this come about, bro?
So, I was just before Baker Boy, I was in a band called Super Heist. So, I did an album.
You're in with Super Heist?
Yeah.
I remember Super Heist. That's awesome, brother.
Yeah, so we did the album Ghost of the Social Dead.
Yep.
And we did an EP as well, Lights. So I went over to America and did the album, and we did a couple of tours and whatever else. And for whatever reason, there's a lot of media outlets that like to grab everything I say about this band and post it. So I won't say too much, but we parted ways. And I started playing for a brother named Philly, who was under Bad Apples Music.
Briggs's Bad Apples,
Briggs's Bad Apples. I was playing for Philly, and you know, I did a couple of shows with Nookie as well back in the day. Mm-hmm. So I started getting into that hip hop stuff, and I'm like, I want to start playing with Blackfellas again. I want to start playing in community, and you know, I was kind of leaving all the big touring and the bands and the labels and the crap behind. I didn't want to do it anymore. I'm like, I'm going to play Blackfella, I'm going to play local, I'm going to play, you know, Bad Apples, I'm going to play, that's where I want to live. Mm. And, you know, some stuff happened where, you know, our DJ moved over to New Zealand, and Philly kind of lost a little bit of love for what he was doing. So, you know, we took a bit of a hiatus and a break, and I got a bit itchy. I was working with a couple of other different artists doing bits and pieces, and I got a call one day from a mate, Tara, who's a producer, and he goes, "Look, I've got this kid, Aboriginal kid, and we're trying to put a band together for him. He's only got one song, and when they just put it on YouTube for fun, and it blew up. So he's like, we want to write some more songs, and you know, he wants an Aboriginal drummer. He goes, I've told him he needs a DJ, but for some reason, he wants a drummer, because if you go up north, like, the big thing is the drummer. Everyone wants a drummer. So he goes, he wants a drummer that can play the backing tracks. I'm like, God, okay. So send me a couple of songs. We'll have a look. And he sent me one song, and I'm like, yeah, I don't know if I want to do it. Like, I'm pretty seasoned. This kid's pretty fresh. And the one song they sent me, I was a bit like, look, I might pass on it.
So you're like, he's too green, I'm going to turn him down.
Well, it wasn't that. It was like, you know, I was going from all these professional acts to, I'm like, I didn't want to come and babysit another new kid.
Yeah, yeah.
And I'm like, you're working on new songs, yeah? And they're like, yeah. I'm like, send me something else. I said, that I don't know about that song. It isn't sparking anything for me. And they're like, all right, we'll send you the two new singles we've just recorded, like, the last 2 days. I'm like, okay. He sent me Black Magic and Mariuna.
Ooh.
So I'm sitting on my couch at home. I think I got 40 seconds into Mariuna, and that was it. I was sold. I was done. I rang him back. I'm like, tell his management to ring me. I'm in. Let's do this. He goes, what changed? I'm like, whatever you gave this kid from this song to the new songs, keep giving it to him, because I can now see this kid has something. There's something there that's really, really special. Like the first song was, you know, it was a kid writing his first rap. I'm like, that's really cool. Good on him. But yeah, as a professional musician, I don't know if it's a trailer when I go down. But then when I heard Muddy Una, I was like, okay, this kid's actually progressing. There's something there, and there's something really special about him. A week later, it was me and Baker Boy in a rehearsal room at Three Phase Studios. It was me and iPod and Baker Boy.
Yeah, what? So they flew him down? Was he already in Victoria?
No, so he was living in Melbourne. Yeah.
Ah, right, at the time.
So he was already living in Melbourne. Yeah. Because he was working with a dance company at the time, and he was based out of Melbourne at that time.
Yeah, because he's got some grooves on the feet too, the fella.
Oh, God, yeah. Oh, God, yeah. He does a lot of things that I wish I could do, but I'm now too old and jaded to learn. So I let him do that stuff. But, yeah, that's how it all kicked off. And for the next, 2 years, it was me, Denzel, and an iPod and a couple of dancers and Dallas and Kian. But the very first one was, it kicked off with us too. So we just had, a month ago was our 5 years together as a group. Well, between me and Denzel, the first time we met was nearly 5 years ago.
Yeah, that's gone quick. Guys, like, Denzel, but yourself, but the band as a whole has had a pretty meteoric rise, I reckon. So for sure, not just nationally, but overseas. But was it easy just kicking off, sitting in there with each other when he's, spitting out lyrics and you're on the drums, just getting the creative juices flowing?
It was. It was like, because it was just the two of us, and he'd already had set in stone, I guess, what we needed to perform. Because I got asked to play two shows and two shows only. Mm. So there was a Red Bull show, and then there was Big Sound. They were the two shows that we were going to do. So everything was kind of set in stone. I just had to learn the songs and I kind of tried to guide him through a little bit of stuff, what to say in between songs and a bit of stage presence stuff. So I actually set the room up like the live show. I said, we're going to pretend we're playing a live show and you're going to talk to the crowd. We're going to do this, we're going to do that and everything else. So we did the two shows. I couldn't believe that his first ever show, it was like 600 people. I'm like, okay. And I'm kind of tracking all this as we're going. I'm like, okay, 600 people at this thing. Like, am I that out of the loop when it comes to like mainstream music? And then we play Big Sound, and Big Sound sold out. I was like, wow, this is a kid's, his first two ever shows. He sold out his first show. My first show was in front of my parents and my band members' parents, and maybe one of them had a girlfriend. That was about it.
And maybe the sheep or dog in the corner.
Yeah. I'm like, okay, this is really special. So, we all had a really, really good time at those shows, and I offered my services. I'm like, look, bros, if you want me to stay on, or if you need a drummer, like, let me know. Like, I have nothing else going. It's either this or I pack my shit up and work a full-time job. Like, that's, I'm going to leave that in your hands. And then my email inbox just started flooding with show bookings. This is what we've got coming up. That's how it kicked off, and it just blew up from there.
And like, how did it feel the first time, whether this was in practice, jamming, or if you're out on stage and just seeing the crowd reactions, just when Denzel's just going from English and then bang, he's speaking in his native tongue.
Yamamata. Yeah.
Like, how did that make you feel?
Look, at the start, at the first couple of rehearsals, and I mean, when I first heard Muddy Una, and then I was like, again, this is something really special. Like,
a few
people have sung in language, but I've never heard anything like this before. But the first couple of rehearsals and that kind of stuff, it was very much work. It was like, I need to get this kid show ready. I wasn't really concentrating too much about anything else except for the work body of it. His kit needs to be show ready. The songs need to be tight. The setup needs to be right. Everything needs to be organized. My drum kit needs to be there. Like technical stuff, everything needs to be on cue. So it was more so that. And the first show was very much, again, work. I had to get it in and get it done. I had my in-ears in. I just listened to the track. We just made it happen. And I'm like, the first show's out the way, the rehearsal's out the way. It was big sound where I actually sat back, played, but also was a part of the show and watched Denzel. And it was then it was like, oh, shit, okay, this is where I am. Wow. This is it. This is the jam. It wasn't until Big Sound. Big Sound was the first show that we played together. I went, wow, this is really, really, this is more than what I could have ever imagined it to be. If we play in front of 200 people for the rest of their lives, I reckon we would have been happy.
Yeah, 100%. And what's the crowd reactions like when they saying, because there'd be so many people like within the crowd where that would be their, you know, around the nation where that would be their first time hearing Aboriginal language.
Yeah. To hear, I mean, it was really the festivals that, you know, our first festival run was Groovin' the Moo. I mean, we played one laneway show before that, but it was Groovin' the Moo that really kicked it off. And I think the biggest thing around language and non-Indigenous people hearing language for the first time is listening to everyone sing Mariuna, listening to 25,000 white people sing Mariuna in language is one of the most amazing things I've ever seen in my life and amazing thing I've ever heard. And remember, I wear in-ears, so they're sound compressed. I actually can't hear anything outside of, but I can hear every single one of those people singing Mariuna. That's like, you're not only playing music that's fun and edgy and whatever else, but you're actually educating people as well without even realizing it.
Yeah, you took the words out of my mouth. I was about to say that's an education lesson too.
Yeah. I mean, we sit there and watch it and go, none of you mob have any idea what we're talking about, like what the lyrics mean, but you're singing them. That's all that matters. Like you're using that language. And yeah, again, to hear 20,000 people sing Mariuna, but not just Mariuna, like the pre-chorus to Mariuna and even doing the dance moves. And I'm like, this is the best. It's so special.
Yeah, that's nuts. And, you know, and it makes me feel that, you know, because I know limited words like with my own language and because like not my grandfather, he went through the Stolen Generation and we've got mob that can speak language and, but where say on our Wanneroo side, I know a lot of it's regaining, they're starting to teach the youngsters, but I hear like what you're doing with Baker Boy and where it's going from English to language, you know. And then I'm just like, man, I wish I could just pick up and get in and have a crack at that too. And hopefully I can. And it inspires me to look more in depth, you know, within myself and Aboriginality and language, you know, which is very important, you know, for First Nations people around the way. But so with your touring, like, have you gone out to, like, remote communities and, like, throughout Australia?
Yeah, so we probably my favourite one so far, we did Freedom Day Festival in Kalgoorlie, which is this beautiful, beautiful, beautiful place in the Centre Desert in Northern Territory. We've done, is it Pinjarra Festival, which is out past Katherine?
Yep.
We've done well. He actually played a show in Milangimbi. That's up northeast Armland. That's where
he played at home. Yeah,
he did play at home. This was a long, long time ago. He played at home, and unfortunately, because of the type of work that I do, we had some emergency stuff happening at work, and I wasn't able to go. Which I'm still spewing to this day. But at the same time, there's the sandflies up there. Most of the dancers come back covered in sandfly bites. So I'm kind of like, yeah, I'm kind of glad I didn't go now. So I would have come home looking like a roast beef. But yeah, so they've done up there. Denzel's done a lot of outer skirts and rural stuff before Baker Boy. So I've done a little bit of stuff with him, you know, whenever we've had the opportunity or chance to, but you know, I guess with COVID at the moment too, like any opportunity is any opportunity at the moment. But no, we love going out to those rural communities. It's just, you know, when and how and logistics of it, because it, you know, can take up a lot of time to get out there. But we get out there whenever we can because we love it. It's beautiful going out there.
Awesome. But just what that brings to the local communities too, like just seeing the faces on some of the mob out there and just what, you know, music for the soul, brother. So, and especially having, you know, a whole, you know, Aboriginal contingent, and especially when you've got language that's flowing over and just, you know, that's going to give inspiration to a lot of mob, whether that's singing or doing what you're doing behind the drums, you know, smashing it out on the skins, which is, you know, very special. So have you done much stuff overseas?
There was a show booked in Norway, a festival.
Wow.
And they, I couldn't make Norway either. I couldn't go. But they took a brother boy of mine who's filled in for me a couple of times, Michael. So he was always like my go-to fill-in brother. He's a Koori lad. He works at the university here in Melbourne.
Nice.
But yeah, when they went out to Norway and played a festival out there, and you know, their memories from that was amazing. But we did have a lot of overseas stuff booked. You know, we had the UK booked and we had South by Southwest booked. But again, COVID come through and took our first couple of international tours, which I'm spewing on because I've got lots of friends over in America and I would have loved to have gone to LA and that and caught up with everyone. But oh well, next time. It'll come back around eventually.
Yeah, it will.
Hopefully
it will.
I'm not too old for it by then.
Nah, you'll be right, bro. 33, come on, Jesus.
Oh, by the time all this crap settles down and around the world, I could be in my late 40s by then.
I know, it's a tricky one.
Well, let's hope not.
So within, like, you know, there's Baker Boy going on. So is there other artists that you're jumping in with, like whether, because I know you've done a bit of work with like Dallas Woods, and is there other mob that you're jumping in and having a crack with? So what's going on in there, mate?
Yeah, so I was I did a lot of stuff for Dallas at the start of his career. You know, he was Baker Boy's hype man, so it was just natural that I went over and played for Dallas as well. But with everything being so busy, there was always a plan for Dallas to have his own band eventually. Because, you know, I didn't want to book a show with Dallas. And then Denzel goes, look, we're playing Adelaide that day. And then I leave Dallas for nobody. So it was, you know, and Dallas has his own band now, which are a brilliant band of brothers. They're unbelievable. So I'm not with Dallas anymore. I mean, Dallas is still my closest brother and I love him to death and I'll always support him. But no, he's got his own trail now and I love seeing the stuff that he's doing. I do play in a crappy new metal cover band with some friends. So Kobe from Boris the Blade is in that band. So we started that together and it's called Break Stuff.
Break Stuff.
It's called Break Stuff and we play new metal covers.
Nice.
It's like an every 3 to 6 month thing. We'll play a show or two. We'll go out. You know, everyone's getting a bit older and everyone's having families and buying houses and whatnot. I'm like the only one that's not. So, you know, we play this little cover band so we can hang out and have a beer or two and still play music. And there's no stresses of writing or releasing because we're playing Limp Bizkit covers. It's like, it's nice and easy. So yeah, I've got that, but that's all I've got at the moment. I don't have, you know, the last couple of years, Denzel's taken up so much of my time, thankfully, that I haven't really had time to play with anybody else. And I always just squeeze Dallas in there as well. You know, just before COVID, we did like 78 shows in a year over 12 months.
What?
We did 78 shows over a year.
Jesus.
So, yeah, right. No, there's only 52 weeks in a year. So, yeah, we bashed out 78, 79 shows in a year. So, of course, every weekend I was away somewhere. Every Thursday I was flying somewhere and every Monday I was flying home from somewhere. So, didn't really have time to do anything else.
Yeah, well, you won't have much time to do anything else if these COVID rules start relaxing a bit and with the new album coming up then, yeah? So, What's the plans, brother? Yeah. Tell us what's going on.
Yeah, well, the album drops on the 15th of October. Denzel actually just released that he's dropping a new song on Friday called Butterflies.
Okay.
Now, the most exciting thing about this track is even I haven't heard it yet, so I'm going to hear it with everybody else.
Wow.
Which I kind of like. Because it's like, oh, this is exciting. I get to hear the song with everyone else. There's no, like, spoilers.
Yeah.
So he's dropping Butterflies on Friday, which is this Friday, which is, I can't remember the date. What's the date of this Friday? 17th of September. Butterflies comes out, and then Gear Love comes out on the 15th of October. And obviously we've got the tour that's been announced. But anything else after that, I can't say anything, but just know that we are going to be very busy boys and girls.
Oh, for sure, for sure. And I hope to, you know, when you come around New South Wales way, hopefully the premiere, you know, with COVID and everything going on, that will be vaxxed up to a certain degree, and then they'll start letting people out and letting other people come into the state and tour, and, mate, look forward to it, brother. But apart from this busy schedule that you got coming up and everything else that's going on, just tell us about where, you know, you're squeezing your own personal projects and, you know, whether that's got to do with, you know, anything that revolves around mental health, or if it's got to do around with photography, and because it seems like, and with your photography, I can see there's a, from what I see, right, like just from the outset, a lot of emotion coming from some of these photos, like, you know, there's some deep stuff going on there. So wherever it's got to do with that, and even your music stuff, like, just take us through some of this personal journey that you're going through.
Yeah, well, I'll start with my solo music stuff, because someone's getting a sack over this, I reckon. I was shortlisted for the Archie Roach Foundation Emerging Talent Award for my solo music. Now, I reckon someone's getting sacked for that, because I don't reckon I should have been on that list.
Don't be modest.
All jokes aside, it's pretty amazing. Look, I'm not going to win it. I'm not going to come anywhere close to it. I mean, I'm up against some of the most amazingly talented solo musicians and groups. But it's very humbling to know that, you know, someone was either drunk enough or smart enough or liked my music enough to put me in the same room as their mom as a solo artist. But I've been more using and going to the mental health side. I've been more using this as a lesson tool for people in the context of, I was told by a lot of people to not release my own solo music. I have I was told by a lot of people to not release anything. Cause it's very punky. It's not clean. It's not produced. It's not, I wanted that 70s Misfits, Ramones, dirty, but it's just an acoustic guitar. There's no distortion or drums or anything. I wanted it nice and dirty and raw. And I'm using it as a, don't listen to what other people say. Like, if you want to do something artistically, just do it. Like, other people's opinions really don't matter at the end of the day. I mean, I never put my stuff up and promoted the hell out of it. I put one post up and go, hey, release a new song. If you care, go listen to it. If not, then, you know, whatever. That's cool too. I'll post something about Baker Boy tomorrow if that's what you really want to see. that's now I feel like I need to release another song, because
you got to back it up now.
I got to try and back it up now. So I've been sifting through all my old demos to try and find something to release. I'm sure there'll be something there I can put up. What else was there? There was my photography. I'll get on.
There's some power in these shots, brother.
Yeah, I so look, I've always loved photography. I've always loved how images can tell more of a story than words can, and it's something that I've wanted to do for a very, very, very long time. And just never did it because I was a music person. I wasn't that side of the artistic world. But, you know, I always go on walks. I take my phone with me and I try and take, you know, cool photos, or, you know, play with Snapseed and Lightroom and different things. And I was talking to a brother boy of mine. I was actually talking to Bala Lou. And, you know, all my hobbies and all my personal life revolves around music. I actually don't have, you know, Baker Boy's my job and my love. And then my solo music was my hobby. And so, well, you're still dedicated to music. There's still, you need something different in your life. And we started talking about photography and how amazing his photography is. And I'm like, I'm going to go get a camera. I'm going to go try this thing. So a few months ago, I went and got a cheapy, crappy little, I got a Fujifilm X-T200. And with
to
the
start.
Yeah, with the little lens that come with it. And I just went out and started taking photos. We went up to Townsville and just started doing bits and pieces for fun. And since then, I've done like 8 online courses. I've sat on YouTube more than I've ever sat on there before. I went and got myself an X-T4 and a couple of lenses. And I'm absolutely loving it. Absolutely loving it. I mean, being locked down at the moment, it's a bit hard to go out and do the stuff that I want to do photography-wise, but it's kind of forcing me to do stuff that I don't want to do and should probably learn. So it's been an adventure. But, you know, I get to, you know, travel and see lots of amazing things. So why not take photos of those things and those people and share them? So I've gone down the photography route.
Yeah, because a lot can come from an image. Like there's a lot that comes from the mediums of music too, but you know, where you can mesh that in with each other, like there's plenty of power in that. And like you said, it's with lockdown, it's those little things that you can work on, whether that's certain tools within Lightroom or an Adobe suite or just, you know, the power of, you know, learning the aperture of lenses and all, because they're so bloody intricate and there's so much that goes on. And that doesn't matter if you got like a bloody $200 camera or you spend the mozza on it. But at the end of the day, it's how you harness it. So
yes, yeah, exactly. Like I've been going on walks up bush near my house and doing nature stuff. Like I never wanted to do nature stuff. I like fluorescent lights and I like dirty streets and graffiti and portraits. So that's the sort of stuff I love. Taking photos of trees and flowers was definitely not going to be my thing. But I've been going on these massive walks up bush and doing nature stuff. Now, look, I haven't posted any of it because a lot of it's crap, but I'm going out and trying to learn how to, you know, do flowers and do, you know, naturescapes and that kind of stuff. So, you know, that's why I haven't posted on there for a little while too, because I haven't got anything. But when touring and starts back up and the world opens back up again, I'll definitely be using that page more and doing a lot more photography.
Yeah, awesome. Mental health. Talk to us about the importance, and especially it's, you know, on the scale big time now, considering COVID and the impact that it's having on, you know, on a lot of people in general, Aboriginal communities, just people across the globe. So,
I actually had this conversation the other night, and I think it's interesting. So I've spent 16 years in the field of, you know, high-risk adolescents and adults and, you know, street works and outreach and out-of-home care and prisons and all that kind of stuff. And I think that the mental health game has changed quite a lot. And I did a podcast the other day with a mental health campaign. And I've actually thought about it since doing that podcast. I'm like, the game's changed so much now.
Yeah.
Like it's not, you know.
It's a lot of awareness about it these days, which is great.
I think there's a lot of awareness. There's not a lot of tools that your average Joe and Jenny can use.
I agree. Yeah.
But I think the game's changed in the way where, you know, you had a percentage or a population of people that had depression or had mental health. And now that everyone's locked inside, you could almost guarantee that every single person in the country has some form of mental health issue or some form of, you know, click or trigger or depression or anxiety or something. They've felt something around those lines. I think the game's changed where we're not looking at a very particular market of people. We're now looking at an entire population of people that we need to help mental health-wise. And it's a big thing for me in that sentiment that, you know, we can't always expect people to speak up when they feel upset. When you have depression, especially if you have suicidal ideation, the first thing that you think of is nobody cares. The first thing you believe in your head is that nobody cares about you. So it doesn't matter if you're here or not. A person in that frame of mind is not going to contact you and tell them that they're not okay. that's one thing I don't like about a lot of these campaigns, like speak up if you're not okay. It's like, well, they're not going to. There's a percentage of people that aren't going to speak up, and those percentages that don't are the percentage that we have in our suicide rates.
That's
so
right.
what we actually need to do as a society is be a little bit more caring about other people, and we actually need to check in on people, and we need to destigmatize the words depression, the word suicide, the word mental health. We actually need to talk about it more. We need to open that door for someone else. You know, if I feel crap, I don't actually ring people and tell them I'm not okay. I just ring them up and see how they are. I ring them up and go, but then it can open the door for me. If I ring someone and they go, well, how are you traveling, bros? I then have the decision and the openness and calmness to go, you know what, man? No, not really. I'm not doing that.
Yeah. See, that's good. And then it opens up, like you said, and then it's a two-way conversation, and that, you know, where you, what you're putting across in it, where that can help out the other person. But then that's self-reflection too. And it opens up maybe some wounds here or there or whatever it may be, where it helps you heal, or just where you need to just talk about a certain thing that's going to help you at the end of the day. And that's huge. And you're spot on when you're talking about the tools. It's, you know, how to utilize them and just, and checking in with people, because people, like you said, these campaigns will go out, but then, okay, they're out there, but then what happens after that? They just sort of wait for people? No, you got to sort of see if you can reach out. So
yeah, like there needs to be professional groups and mental health groups that give people the harder tools. You know, what if I ring someone, let's say I'm Everyday Joe, and I've never worked with mental health, never even seen someone with depression before, and I ring a mate and go, look, you're not traveling well, you've been okay, and he goes, no, I want to kill myself, I want to die now. What does me as an Everyday Joe do about that? Because that's a big door to open.
It is.
It's huge.
And you don't know which way it will go. Yeah.
Exactly. And then what are the tools for me to, one, take care of myself and support myself, but then actually be able to support my friend or partner or whatever, family member, associate, neighbor, to get through what they're going through without having, because then there's that thin line of professional and law as well. So if I'm an Everyday Joe and I talk to someone and say certain things or go a certain way, then legally there can be some mix up in did you teeter them over the edge as well. But then there's that,
if you want to know the barriers,
you want to know where you can and can't go, you want to know what you can and can't do, and you want to know who you can and can't call. They're the biggest things. And I mean, there's my biggest thing I say to anyone is there's short day courses in mental health first aid. They're not expensive.
I always implore
people to go to them. Yep. Go and book in for mental health first aid. It takes you through mental health, suicidal ideation, how to talk to people, and they give you a little booklet at the end and go, this is what you do and this is how you support people.
Spot on, brother. And the thing is, that too, when you're talking about the mental health first aid, where a lot of you got some companies running them like all over the country, but where you got a lot of them now where they push in that Aboriginal focus and bring in the cultural elements, which is, it's huge. So it's just given that extra perspective for someone that's not Aboriginal and doesn't identify in that way, but wants to know about mob and, you know, where it's just everybody trying to help each other. So, and I've done, you know, the course, this is like a while back, but just seeing how people's eyes would open just when they were talking about like psychosocial disabilities and schizophrenia, like what it's like. And then they had like, say it's me and you talking like this.
Yeah.
And then I'd have two people side by side talking to me about different things at the same time. And I'm trying to hold a conversation with with you, but I've got all these conversations going in my head. So I've given that perspective and it's like, whoa, you know, and just seeing the room of everybody sort of looking at that and really taking that in. So like you said, you're spot on. If anybody's hearing this, give it a crack and, you know, get more perspective on mental health and where that gives internal tools for yourself or, you know, you know, or where you can obviously talk to other people and help them. And mate, I hope you you know, where what I'm thinking, right, because the state government down in Victoria, they pretty sure they just announced it yesterday, they're going to be throwing millions like in regards to mental health and helping organisations and individuals. And, yeah, you know, you're pretty articulate and I know you got a lot on, but, you know, maybe some of that could be channeled into what you're doing. I don't know. But I think, no, straight up, brother, I think you could help a lot of people out there. So that's being straight up honest. So, and
I think my stuff is very, very awareness type. Like I'm lucky to have a very small online platform. In the sense of the actual on the ground work, I love the on the ground work that I do, and unfortunately, I can't really say what I do specifically for a job. But it's in this same type of world, but on the absolute opposite spectrum to your normal everyday. I feel sad. I'm very much on the other end of that.
Yeah.
But yeah, there's a lot of money going into organizations, and I just hope that they do the right thing and set up the right programs and have the right formation to actually help people and not just paint pretty pictures on a poster and put them on Facebook.
Yeah, 100%, because you don't want to see that money get wasted or go to organizations that are just going to take the money for the sake of it and not really put across the appropriate means, because that stuff always happens with funded money and where things go and where they should and where they shouldn't. But anyway, as long as I think it's, you know, like what we've talked about here, it's more known and hopefully it gets utilized the right way and you keep doing what you're doing, because you're doing great work, you know, brother. But okay, so tattoos, you got a fair few of them, which is which I love, the one on the neck, and I'm the same. I've got both arms sorted out, but mate, just take us through like some of your ink work and, you know, what's your general favorite, or say one of your favorites that's got solid meaning to it. Just give us a rundown on that.
Funnily enough, Sharpie, Boris, Defect, everything else. So Sharpie's actually my tattooist, and I was the first ever person that he tattooed. Just going to throw that out there.
Yeah.
I don't particularly have, look, I'll be really blunt. I've got a lot of dead people tattooed on me, and not the sense of zombies, but in the sense of people that in my life that have passed away. Mm-hmm. So I'm actually looking at blacking a lot of my tattoos out at some point, because my tattoos are just they're just sheets of people who have passed away. But my favorite ones are my hands. So if you can see, I've got, that's a purple gardenia on my hand, and then I've obviously got the Koori flag blended in there.
Yeah, I love that.
So my grandmother's favorite flower was a gardenia, and her favorite color was purple. So I got a purple gardenia on my hand for when she passed. Then on this hand is a big reason, like I've always done, like I've got my little Union Jack, which is, no, it's not an Australian flag. It's my dad's side. So I got my mom and my dad. I've got, actually, it's his initials, so MW. So I've always done work in this space, but he was one of my best mates that I found after he had done the deal.
Sorry to hear about that, eh?
It was a long time ago now, and he's definitely left me with more than he took away from me after years of really seeing what he did for me as a person. And he's given me this drive to really do this stuff publicly and really talk about it and really open up around mental health. I mean, I've lost a lot of friends to suicide and self-harm and murder and drugs and all that other fun stuff too. They're probably my main two. Actually, my favorite one is, I probably won't be able to get my leg up that high, but my tour nickname is Pug.
Nothing to do with a dog with it or what?
No, so from where Denzel's from, apparently the pug is like the protector of the community, is like the staunch, the tough one, the one that makes sure everyone's okay, and like is the first in a fight, and he looks after everyone. So kind of like the badass mama bear type thing. So I've actually got a pug, like the dog, a pug face tatted on my leg, and he's wearing a bandana and it's an Aboriginal flag. And that's probably one of my other favorites as well.
That's awesome. Yeah, me mother-in-law's got one of those, and God, they bloody molt, I tell you. They're a short-haired dog. I thought they wouldn't molt, but they bloody spread it everywhere. But they're characters. But anyway, that's awesome, the meaning behind that, and that's important. But, you know, what you guys would carry from tour to tour and just when you're getting around as a whole and having, you know, power of the pug, brother. That's awesome.
That's it. That's it.
Okay. Is there anything on the horizon that you want to let people know about of what's going on, whether it's your personal journey and what you're going through or general tour and stuff? What do you want to throw out in the atmosphere, brother?
Bro, the hardest thing right now is I don't know. Every day, everything's day by day at the moment. So you just have to keep up on the socials and see what happens. Because when you find out, it's when I find out. So it's, there's nothing happening in the horizon except for, you know, the album launch tour, which is still happening. Fingers COVID, come on, open up. We're going to do this bloody tour. again, don't know what's happening. So it's day by day, moment by moment, and even minute by minute at the moment. So you just have to check back and ask again when I'm allowed outside my house.
Yeah, it feels like that. I'm hearing you. So if people want to get a hold of you, you know, whether it's socials or whatever it may be, throw that out there so they can see the good, important work that you're doing, whether that's got to do with your drama, music, photography, whatever.
Yeah, so everything pretty much goes to at @BC_drumwarrior. That's my main Instagram page. And you can find all my other stuff in my bio on there. But I don't really use Facebook or anything else. So it's pretty much my go-to, that Instagram page.
Nice.
That's my everything.
We're telling you, you know, brother, you know, really appreciate you coming on and having a yarn and just being open and honest. And, you know, because that's what I love about, you know, just these mediums and podcasting and just bringing on people like yourself, just, you know, if it's breaking down barriers or just having straight up truthful yarns, you know.
Yeah.
And whether that can resonate with someone, you know, in the local community or beyond that. So, and that's what it's all about, just spreading the love and hopefully, you know, COVID does, yes, fingers crossed, and you're able to, you know, get that kit behind you and get that around the country and spread that love, brother, because you are doing awesome work behind that kit from what I've seen, like online, and love what you're doing. And just you're a tight drummer, man, like, and just keeping the tunes and just being able to adapt and, like, you know, where you've done multiple different facets of styles of drumming and where you're, you know, carving that up and where you're doing that solid work with Baker Boy and outside of that. So you keep that up.
And, thank you, my bro.
Yeah, and just especially with, you know, when it's got to do with this mental health stuff and, you know, and your strong character, bringing strong yarns and you're a, you know, solid, staunch and up front, and you know, I love it and keep it up. So really appreciate it.
No, thank you, my brother. I really appreciate you having me on. It's been awesome.
Cheers, bro. Take care.
Deadly. Wanna.
Awesome. See, folks, solid yarn, eh? Really enjoyed it. And just seeing his love of music. And I've got a deep love and appreciation for it too. And when it's got to do with metal, hip hop, hardcore punk and everything in between. And the solid work he's doing with Denzel. Them two fellas and the rest of the crew getting around the nation and elsewhere. Getting out solid tunes. Doing solid work. I know it means a lot to our people. True. Straight up. Keep pumping those tunes. And if you like the podcast, hit that subscribe button. Be much appreciated. And we've also got a Patreon page. The link is within the description. So if you jump into that, check it out. And if you want to become a part of the squad and help further support the channel and contribute, that would be awesome. And if you want to get in contact with me, you can get me via Instagram @StreetRollingCheetah or email one word, StreetRollingCheetah@gmail.com. And we've also got a Facebook page, Keep Rolling with Jake Briggs, so check it out. And want to thank our sponsors, Permbill Australia, the greatest electric wheelchairs in the land. Wouldn't be sitting in anything else but these four wheels right here, and they've got great assistive tech also. So righto, see you on the next one.